Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who like books. My name is Heather Wardover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 91. Eek! A man! This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. Carolina Homespun at carolinahomespun.com and the Golden Gate Fiber Institute. Join in the fun and excitement at the first summer intensive from July 28th through August 3rd of 2008. You can reach them at goldengatefiberinstitute.org. Well, hi there. I am ridiculous. I am podcasting today with my headset half off because I have to listen for the plumber. Because for the last week, we have not had hot water. Actually, that's not true. We had hot water for about an hour. It kind of was coming and going for a while, and then it just stopped. And today is Friday, and it stopped on Tuesday. I have been washing my hair in cold, cold water, and the boys really, really need a bath or a shower or something. So if the plumber doesn't come soon, we're all going to go to the gym and take a shower there. We go to the YMCA up here by us in Tucson, and it's really wonderful, but it's not kind of the same thing as getting to take a shower at home. But of course, this is the week that I had to have the water die out, because this was the week that I finished my Fiber Trend felted clogs. We had a challenge that was given to us by a woman who passed away in this last year at our spinning guild, that we were supposed to make something that was reminiscent of, in color or format or style or something, reminiscent of the Sonoran Desert. So I have done my felted Fiber Trend clogs in that way, and I will be using these on the Sea Sox cruise for the slipper competition. So I'm not putting up pictures of these yet. They will come later, though. But I was in this clog frenzy mood, and so I had finished doing all the knitting, and I really needed to felt them. I really needed to felt them. They must be felted. So I boiled at least six, maybe eight stock pots full of boiling water and poured them into my washer. And they did eventually felt. I was very happy, but I don't think they felted firmly enough. So I don't know. They fit, but they're a little loose. And it said if they're a little loose in the width, you're supposed to kind of pull them vertically to stretch them out and make them narrow themselves a bit. And I did that, and that sort of worked. But I'm not actually entirely sure how these are supposed to fit my feet. So if you have a pair of Fiber Trend clogs, please email me at mamaoknits@gmail.com and let me know what the fit is like for you. I'm curious. Yesterday I did a new thing. I went to our knitting guild meeting, and it was interesting. It was very different from a spinning guild meeting. The women at the spinning guild are adventurous. I really like our spinning guild. And there's quite a bit of overlap between our knitting guild and our spinning guild. And I didn't really meet a whole lot of new people at the knitting guild, so I can't comment on the people. What I can say is that they do a remarkable amount of outreach. They do clothes for teddy bears, and then they donate the teddy bears and the teddy bear clothes to the police department, so that when the police have to pick up a child from a traumatic situation, they have something wonderful and warm and squishy for them in the police car. And the cops travel around with these teddy bears in their car, which I thought was very cool. They do Linus blanket, they do chemo caps, and they do Navajo sweaters for Navajo children up on the reservation, where it does get, in fact, really cold. I know, you think Arizona and you think 110 in the shade, which it happens, but in the high desert, when you get up around Flagstaff, northern New Mexico, Flagstaff, areas like that, Zion, Bryce in southern Utah, Monument Valley, all these kinds of places, winter gets cold. really cold, really cold. And there's snow and there's wind. So I was really impressed about that with the Knitting Guild. But the program yesterday at the Knitting Guild was for a yoga teacher who came in to do specific yoga moves that would be beneficial to people who sit in a particular position and do things like, you know, knit for long periods of time. And I was horrified because of two things. One, she said, okay, we're going to do neck rolls. And so Heather immediately, being the overzealous student that she often is, started to roll her neck. As the words left the teacher's mouth, that went something like this. Now, the way that people do this wrong and wind up hurting their neck is, look at the picture of Heather doing what the teacher is talking about. I put a kink in my neck, a really bad one, and I learned, oh, I don't know, 7.5 seconds later, that if I had merely raised my shoulders to kind of give my very heavy head a padded surface upon which to roll over at the back of my neck, I would have preserved it and not have injured myself. I'm feeling much better today. I don't know if it was the painkiller that I took last night so that I could sleep or what, but it is much better, and for that I am really thankful. But that was interesting, and I did learn about a bunch of other yoga moves. The second thing that kind of horrified me, I'm trying not to sneeze right now because it is pollen season here in the Southwest. The second thing that really surprised me, though, was that there were stretches with my arms. I'm used to not being able to do stretches with my legs. I have never been able to do the splits. I've never been able to, you know, do anything much like that. But my arms, I've always thought, were okay, and my hands were okay. Sometimes my wrists get sore if I type too much, but I think that's also neck strain. Well, you can do this with me right now. Reach your arms out to your sides, you know, so that you look like a big giant T with a head in the middle, and then take your fingertips, and instead of having them point out from you horizontally, have them point up. I do this, and I feel the stretch in my wrists and in the middle of my palms, and especially on my right hand side, in my middle finger. I can't actually do that and keep my middle finger straight. So Heather learned that Heather needs to stretch, and not stretch in any kind of sweat producing way, but just simple things like put your arms out at your side and make your fingertips point up. It was really a surprise. The other quick thing that I can tell you, because I don't think you really need to see it, is if you raise one of your arms from the elbow, so you put your arm straight out in front of you and then lift the elbow, so now again your fingertips are pointing up to the ceiling and you've made kind of an L or a 90 degree angle out of your arm. If you take your opposite hand to grab kind of that fleshy part on the inside of your forearm, grab and pinch pretty hard and flop your wrist and hand forward, and then flop your wrist and hand back, and then move up, you know, just a centimeter, move up, pinch again, flop forward, flop back, go up another little bit, flop forward, flop back. It's just, I think, moving all the pieces around in your wrist, and go all the way up until you're pinching your wrist, and gets the blood flowing. It's kind of like doing deep tissue massage without deep tissue massage, kind of like doing acupressure without doing acupressure. It felt good. And I think it will feel good to you too. So I'm passing that along for you. I am right now in a gym frenzy. I already said we were going to go to the gym for showers, but I'm also going to try and work out. As you probably have learned, I don't. I really don't. I really don't like going to the gym. I don't mind doing things. I love playing racquetball. I love going skiing. I love going ice skating. I like going bike riding. But, you know, going to a gym is pretty, really terminally boring for me. But I'm taking my sock knitting, and I'm going to get on the treadmill. I'm going to walk really fast. I'm going to knit my socks. And then I'm going to try and do a few machines, because at the end of my session, I can go sit in the sauna or the steam room. Either one. I have a choice, because we had to join a different gym So our children will still take the karate class at the YMCA, but we're switching to a different gym because at that gym, there is a really good preschool, which happens to be next door to the school that my older son is going to. So thing one and thing two will be at schools that are next door to each other, and there's a gym there. So now I kind of have no excuse. If I can't make it to the gym now, when I have to walk into the building already, then I just will be way, way, way too pathetic. And I don't think I can let myself be that pathetic. I'm sure if I really tried, I could. But it's not going to happen. Not today, anyway. I have a new audio player up on the website. So if you are one of the people who prefers to listen to the podcast via show notes website, the player will be there. It doesn't have any bells or whistles on it. It merely plays the latest show. So you can't go back in time like you used to be able to with the GCast player and listen to old episodes. It will only be the most current one. All of the previous episodes are still downloadable from the library on the side. So those are pretty much your two options. And if I can figure out a way to do a player that I can load all of the previous episodes into, I will absolutely do that. If you know of any that will do that, please let me know. But for now, this was the best I could do. That GCast player simply could not play anything that was significantly over an hour. It's the only thing I can figure out that was wrong with it. So I am sorry about that, but there it is. I had a lot of emails this week, so I have a couple of things to say. The first is a big thank you to Jessica Tyler and Deborah Schroeder. Deborah Schroeder sent me an email about tea. And she said, my favorite tea shop online is Teavana, like Nirvana, but Teavana, get it? And I will put a link to that in the show notes. They sell the tea by the ounce and they sell them loose. If you order them, make sure you get one of the tins to store the tea in. It will keep the tea fresh for months versus the few days to a couple of weeks that you get in the bags. And she said that she particularly likes to combine the silver needles with rooibos. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It is R-O-O-I-B-O-S. It's a South African tea. Actually, it's South African grass, I think. Like lemongrass makes lemongrass tea. I think rooibos makes rooibos teas. And they're naturally decaffeinated. So she said she likes the combination of silver needles and rooibos macadamia because the taste of the silver needles by itself is pretty darn strong. So she highly recommends those teas. And then Jessica Tyler sent me a gift certificate for Adagio teas. And I will also put a link to that tea company in the show notes as well. I am very excited. Thank you both for sending me that information. That's exactly what I was hoping to find. Jan, my stepmom, has introduced me to a kind of shoe called a fit flop, not a flip flop. It is super squishy. It's rubbery. She had me try hers on, and it was like shoe-vana. It was shoe heaven. So I'm going to put a link to the fit flop site. You know, no affiliation, yada yada, but really nice shoes. I highly recommend you take a look. Also, I just got an email in my Gmail box, and I have no idea if you have ever heard of these before. For all I know, I may have talked about this 2 years ago. The Stars Bunny Club, STARZ. This is where some really crazy woman has done versions of just a ton of very popular movies reenacted by bunnies, and all of them are 30 seconds or less, in the case of It's a Wonderful Life. Hysterical. And they just came out with Jurassic Park, which I thought was, as always, stupendous. Really, really well done. So I'll put a link to that website in the show notes as well. Sometimes they swear in some of the bunny movies. So they're not always, you know, you want to preview them before you let a little kid watch. But if it's a teenager, I think we're pretty much fine. And now, as I look through my copious notes, because once again, I had to have copious notes for today, I have a promo for you, which doesn't happen very often. So I'm very excited. Here you go.
My name's Megan, and I wanted to invite you to join me on a weekly podcast called Stitch It. It's a podcast where I share all of the little bits and bobs that I do every single day. A lot of knitting and crocheting. I'm learning how to spin so you can learn how to spin with me. I tell you about the adventures that I have with my little man. I share a few of my favorite things. And I interview some everyday knitters, talking to them about why they do what they do and what they do while they're doing it. If you're interested, you can find me on iTunes. It's called Stitch It. And otherwise, you can see show notes and learn a little bit more about me at stitchitpodcast.com. I hope you all have a wonderful day. Take care and keep on stitching.
Cool, huh? So Megan and I have been writing back and forth on Ravelry this week, and she asked if I'd play the promo, and I have. She has quite a growing listenership, so you might want to tune in. I have some reviews for you. I am very excited about them. You can hear me getting to the books. Isn't that cool? I can actually see what paper looks like on my GarageBand screen when it records the sound waves. Okay, but enough tech geek fun. The first book that Jamie Gerthels from Interweave Press sent me was Maggie Casey's book, Start Spinning, Everything You Need to Know to Make Great Yarn. And I'm really frustrated that I didn't have this book when I started spinning. It's a really, really good starting place. For a couple of reasons. One is, and if you are Amy Singer, the beginning of this book will definitely be frustrating to you. Amy Singer or someone like Amy Singer. Amy Singer doesn't need this book. She's a great spinner. But the book begins with wool and shows you the construction of wool and wool locks, what a bat is, what sliver is, what roving is, what combed top is. This is stuff I didn't learn until much later, and it's awfully, awfully useful. The other thing that I really like in the book, and it's something that Interweave is just particularly good at, is the photographs. The pictures are A, of Maggie doing what she is telling you to do, which means the picture matches the text, which is so nice. And then she goes into spindles and shows you top whorl and bottom whorl and leaders, and she shows you how to do a quick and ugly lazy Kate for a spindle, which I had made ages ago for my spinning wheel, and by the way, which I still use, my quick and ugly Kate that I made ages and ages ago. It is my primary plying aid. I know there are plenty of people have much, much more attractive lazy Kates than I, and the traveling Kate from Nancy's Knit Knacks, I've heard tell, is very good. But you know, I have my little plastic shoebox that carries other things too, and I can take it with me wherever I go, and then I have a Kate, and it's tensioned, and I love it. Then Maggie goes into details of the wheel, and she tries to use different wheels in the photographs, which I think is also particularly helpful, so that you can kind of see how things would be different on an upright castle versus a traditional Saxony wheel. Maggie also does some really good ergonomic information, which I thought was great. And even though she doesn't seem to get in deep with long shot pictures of lots of different wheels, like you're not going to see her treadling hundreds of different wheels, when it comes to things like changing bobbins, she shows you a Lendrum, she shows you an Ashford, and she shows you a Majacraft, which are the three that really have the most significant differences, I think, as far as knowing what you need to know to be able to get stuff in and out quickly. The only one she doesn't show is a journey wheel, and I'm not sure that that's not just fine. Journey wheels are kind of precious, and while I love mine and love everything that Jonathan and Sheila work on with the Bosworth work, you know, it's Jonathan making this stuff, and I don't think his production numbers have hit Ashford's. So you're going to meet fewer Journey Wheels in your life, not because they aren't wonderful, but just because there aren't going to be that many out there. Same with, you know, Reeves Wheels and Norm Thomas. I got to see one in person. Gorgeous. But I don't have one. Her pictures of the early stages of spinning and what a spinning triangle looks like and what can go wrong. She has wonderful, wonderful things like your yarn won't wind onto the bobbin. What went wrong? She has a picture of the thing that happened to me over and over again on my first Luette. And had I had this book, you can hear that refrain over and over again, I would have solved my problem with a lot less frustration and a lot more quickly. And truly, I mean, she troubleshoots, breaks it down by many things. If your yarn won't wind onto the bobbin, if the wheel is hard to treadle, if the wheel goes backwards, if the yarn is being pulled out of your hands and onto the wheel, if the flyer won't turn when the wheel is treadled, if the yarn is getting too much twist, if the yarn doesn't have enough twist. All of these things, she tells you what to adjust. And I think it is Maggie who walks around the class at SOAR, and people always talk about this later, that people will come to class and say, you know, I just can't seem to X. I can't seem to treadle right. I can't seem to do this, that, or the other thing right. And her response is always, let's adjust your wheel. It's not you. It's the wheel. You just need to have it adjusted correctly. And that's a really, really nice thing to hear from an expert when you are a beginner. That it isn't you. You're doing just as fine as you need to. Spinning wheels aren't rocket science, but if they're adjusted wrong, it won't work. It's pretty much that simple. She has a couple of other great things about plying. She shows a bunch of different Lazy Kate ideas, which, again, really useful. Don't try and ply without a tension Kate of some sort, and Maggie's book will give you lots of ideas. She also has swatches that she has knit up, which shows you often what you need to know about why you need to take some of the steps you need to take, like why do you need to ply yarn. There are lots of reasons why you might not want to, but there are lots of reasons why maybe you should think about it. She also goes into how to finish yarn, how to hang it, how to wash it, and then how to spin consistently, how to calculate yards per pound, and then she talks about actually planning yarn for a project. How do you make a foofy poofy yarn for something that you want to be warm and lofty? How do you make something a little stronger and more solid when you want cables to show? She even has information on weaving. And then ends with fleece and locks, like how to clean said fleece, how to clean and card and prepare so that you can get the yarn you want. In a lot of ways, I feel like this is a pictorial Alden Amos book without the attitude. Alden, who, and I think I've talked about it before, I loved Alden Amos's book, but he is very opinionated. I happen to think he's also right most of the time, so it was an easy read for me. But Maggie's is probably a more user-friendly book, and the pictures in her book are invaluable. She's a wonderful teacher, and I've only had a few opportunities to talk to her in person, but I felt like her warm and generous nature really comes across in the book. So again, that's Start Spinning, Everything You Need to Know to Make Great Yarn from Maggie Casey and Interweave Press. The other book that Jamie sent is Shibori Knitted Felt, and since I'm in a felting frenzy right now, I was really excited to get to take a look at this book. I've seen Shibori work before, and I also realized that I have seen Shibori work and not known it was Shibori. And I hope to God I am pronouncing that right. All of a sudden it dawned on me that I might not be. The patterns in here are wonderfully creative. Some of them are a little busy for me, but they are not busy for other people. I can see a lot of my friends in things like this. Many of the things that are in here. One of the things that I really liked about the book is that I never got the sense while I was reading this that I had to stick to any of these patterns as written. Shibori is such a creative and kind of, I want to say, serendipitous thing. Well, I find felting to be kind of serendipitous. Wet felting. Felting that you stick in the washer and hope to God it looks good when you come out. When it comes out. when you come out of the bar and it comes out of the washer. Oh, I hope that worked out right. But this book has just lovely, lovely work in it. I know for a fact that if I tried to do some of these as my first project, it wouldn't work out at all. But there are some things that I would start with, like potholders. And the potholders, which interestingly comes on, well, she has cushion covers and then you can use it as a cushion cover or as a potholder. Interestingly, this is on page 69. This is well after the beginning of the book. She kind of dives you into some of the main techniques by doing some fairly elaborate looking, but I think simple doing projects. And then, you know, on page 69, when you're almost done with the book, oh yeah, and you can make a potholder. She has really good information on both knitting and knitting things like scarves and spiral scarves and things like that. So you can get some patterns on that. Knitted flowers for making knitted and felted corsages. But she also does some surface design work that is stellar. There is a spiral cushion cover that my husband would love to have me make. But, you know, my fear of embroidery raises its ugly head every once in a while, rears its ugly head every once in a while. And I start to think, well, maybe I could do that. Regardless of whether I attack the embroidery or not, the things to do in this book are fantastic. The patterns are lovely. If you are into felting, especially knitted felting, if you are into knitted felting, this is a book that you should have purely because it's going to give you great ideas of interesting things that you can then go on and do, whether you follow a pattern out of here or not. I don't think you'll feel like you wasted your time. The instruction pages, and I haven't done anything in here, but I have read the instruction pages for kind of the how-to stuff that comes at the back. I'm flipping through to look for it. I've read all the how-to stuff at the back, and I've read through, oh, I don't know, 6 or 7 of the patterns. Nothing struck me as too difficult to attempt. Ooh, there's even placemats. See, now I could do that. All right, but I have too much knitting to do right now, so I can't do that yet. I have to focus. Which reminds me, don't forget that we have the fantastic April incentive going on this month. A few of you have already donated. Thank you so much. You are in the running for the yarn to go with one of the patterns. I'm going to post patterns next week. I was still overwhelmed. I couldn't pick... I couldn't even narrow it down to a few. So I'm going to work with Dixie on that. But go back to last week's show notes, episode 91, and you can get the links to the store so that you can see the kinds of yarn that you might win, and also a link to the patterns so you can see the patterns. I think, again, I'm going to stay with the summer pattern, something light and seasonal. We have a May incentive as well. If you donate in the month of May, there is a Etsy store, clovenpine.etsy.com, the owner of which has donated a skein of Bianca colored sock yarn. You can see the sock yarn in the show notes, and I will have a link to that store as well. The yarn is this gorgeous kind of pink and chocolate color. It reminds me of ice cream. It made me want to eat ice cream. Kind of that Neapolitan color pink and Neapolitan chocolate. It's really good looking. And would make a lovely pair of socks. So that is up for May donations if you would like to hold off and wait until May. I think that does it for the chat. Now, we have some book to get to. Last week, we got introduced to the girls and the drama of their lives. And this week, we meet Lori. For those of you who have read the book before, Lori is one of my favorite characters. For those of you who haven't, we finally get to meet the Lawrence boy who lives next door. And also his grandfather, Mr. Lawrence. There are a couple things to listen for this week. First of all is the work ethic. You will notice that not so much in the first chapter you're going to hear today, but the second chapter, we're going to listen to chapter 3 and 4. You're going to hear a lot about kind of the Puritan work ethic. Well, this makes perfect sense. Louisa May Alcott was raised in the Northeast. Her family was part of the Transcendentalist movement. This is Whitman, Emerson, Thoreau. Whitman and Dickinson are kind of tangential to the Transcendentalist movement, but definitely Emerson and Thoreau. Hawthorne and Melville were considered the anti-Transcendentalists, mostly by themselves. They're darker, they're less hopeful, they're darker. But the Transcendentalists, kind of utopian thinkers, they're kind of similar to the Romantics, but not maybe quite as goofy. They're harder working, they're good New England stock. And the work ethic wasn't just work, 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 we must work, idle hands are the devil's playground, which is kind of part of the way I was raised. And they're not working for material gain. They're not working to get rich. They are working because of two things, I think. One, work was one of the ways that you were allowed to express your creativity. And you hear that in Beth. You heard that last week in Beth, that, you know, she does the housework. And I went to the memorial for one of my best friends from junior high and high school. His grandmother died. And when he got up and spoke at the memorial, he talked about how she really made every moment count. She was just a very happy, loving, giving, generous, warm person, which is how I remember her as well. But he commented that she was so comfortable being who she was that even housework, even washing the dishes, became something that you could do well and that you could take pride in and that you could do, I don't know, creatively. And it struck me rather hard because I am no lover of housework, not that any of us really are, but also because it's so easy for me to forget that you get back what you put in. And it's a lesson that comes across over and over in Little Women. The reminder to be mindful. Be mindful of where you are and what you're doing. And to a certain extent, through that comes satisfaction and happiness. It's not putting up with your lot in life. It's more than that. And you'll hear more of that coming through more and more in the book. There's something else to listen for. Language in this book matters. Louisa May Alcott was a writer. She pretty much supported her family from her writing. She's very much Jo. And her sisters are pretty much the sisters in the book. And we'll do more of her biography, as I've said before, as we continue to go. But the two most creative people in the family, Jo and Amy, the budding artist, are the ones who use language the most. Well, it's kind of a motif that pops up over and over again with them, that Jo swears and uses slang and obviously writes. So she's kind of always pushing the envelope of the language thing. Amy, in her attempt to be refined, is constantly using words that are outside of her sphere of reference and using them incorrectly. But she continues to use them and to try. And of course, through trial and error, she winds up with a very broad, very refined vocabulary. It reminds me of a former boyfriend of mine who, I swear to you, he never went to college. He had no formal education past high school. He was an incredibly smart guy and could hear a new word. And this includes like foreign words. You know, he could hear a new word said in his presence, used in a sentence. And 5 minutes later, he could use that word himself without ever having seen it written down and without having to look it up in a dictionary. Think about it for a minute, how difficult that is for most of us, you know, to acquire language. Usually we have to read a word, I think it's 20 times. Someone's going to correct me on that. You have to read it a bunch. And you have to try using it, probably incorrectly, a couple of times before a word really becomes part of you. He wasn't like that. And Amy appears to have some of that same talent, that same gift. Again, gender roles will play a part in these two chapters. You have Meg and Beth, who are fairly traditional in their gender roles, although every once in a while something is said or something happens that makes you realize that were they living in a different time or in a different place, their dreams for their future might be quite different. Certainly they are constrained by the options that they have, but they are not simple retiring wilting flowers. These are interesting, vibrant, fully realized characters in a book who probably remind you of someone you know. And the interesting thing to me is that the gender role in discussion doesn't end with the girls. Laurie shows up in this new chapter, and he tells us that he is called Laurie because he didn't like the nickname the boys gave him at school, which was Dora. He also pursues music, which is a fairly feminine pursuit at that time. So Laurie is kind of breaking the mold, just like Joe. But on the guy's side of things. And of course, this is no indication that he's gay or anything like that. It's just that what he finds fulfilling is not something that the rest of the society at that time would approve of. And if you're having trouble kind of visualizing where we're at, it's a little bit later, but you can still get a pretty good idea if you watch the Age of Innocence. I think it was Scorsese did his version of the book. And their ability to portray manner and dress on the screen, if you kind of combine the Winona Ryder Little Women and the Winona Ryder Age of Innocence, you'll see kind of the two ends of society. And again, all through these chapters, when you hear the March family talk about being poor, they are not living in poverty. They are middle class. They are simply not wealthy. They can't put on a ball or anything like that. You know, they're closer to Elizabeth Bennet than they are to Mr. Darcy. There's also, you're going to hear more little referrals to Pilgrim's Progress. And if I can remember to, I will put a link to information on Bunyan and Pilgrim's Progress on the show notes. You'll also hear about fire. Fire is going to be a recurring symbol all throughout the book. Fire and scorching and things like that show up over and over, and you'll hear it today. And the last thing I wanted to leave you with before playing these two chapters, and I'm just going to play them back to back for you because there's really no reason for me to break in the middle, is that to me, Marmee is a woman's Atticus Finch. I have always thought in many ways of my dad as being an Atticus, that he was a reserved parent in that he didn't lecture and he didn't ever, you know, berate or wear down or anything like that. There was no nagging in my family. Instead, my dad would ask me questions. Well, I think I told you before that when I was going to a party my senior year, he asked if there was going to be alcohol at the party, and I said yes. And he said, is there anybody there who you like? And I said yes. And he said, well, because you know, a really great way to catch a guy is to throw up on his shoes. And that ended drinking at parties for me for the rest of my life. at least I didn't ever drink to get drunk. That ended there and then. But it was very effective parenting, I thought at the time. It certainly worked on me. But while my dad is in many ways Atticus to me, my mom is in many ways Marmee, because my mom never, ever, ever asked my sister or me to do anything that she wouldn't do herself. And there is a scene that is coming up between Marmee and Joe in a couple of chapters that I think is what clinches it for me about Marmee. She is not shy and retiring. She is not flawless. She is not weak. She is, in fact, I think, one of the toughest female characters written since Lady Macbeth. She's just nice. But nice, I don't know, nice is almost a bad word for her too, because she's more than nice. Generous, kind, thoughtful, smart, tough, and interesting. And, you know, things like the 1950s really did a disservice to women like Marmee. And I think whatever your political view of the actress, I think Susan Sarandon was an excellent choice for the movie because she manages to carry that same kind of strength of character that you need to hear and see and feel from Marmee. And so I enjoy the movie version. I thought the casting was really dead on. And Marmee is my Atticus. And you'll hear a little bit of Marmee today. So I am going to play you two chapters. And I hope you enjoy them. So here we go with chapters 3 and 4 of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott.
Chapter 3. The Lawrence Boy. "Joe? Joe, where are you?" cried Meg at the foot of the garret stairs. "Here," answered a husky voice from above, and running up, Meg found her sister eating apples and crying over the heir of Redcliffe, wrapped up in a comforter on an old three-legged sofa by the sunny window. This was Joe's favorite refuge, and here she loved to retire with half a dozen russets and a nice book to enjoy the quiet and the society of a pet rat who lived nearby and didn't mind her a particle. As Meg appeared, Scrabble whisked into his hole. Joe shook the tears off her cheeks and waited to hear the news. "Such fun! Only see! A regular note of invitation from Mrs. Gardner for tomorrow night," cried Meg, waving the precious paper and then proceeding to read it with girlish delight. "Mrs. Gardner would be happy to see Miss March and Miss Josephine at a little dance on New Year's Eve. Marmee is willing we should go. Now what shall we wear?" "What's the use of asking that when you know we shall wear our poplins because we haven't got anything else," answered Jo with her mouth full. "If only I had silk," sighed Meg. "Mother says I may when I'm 18 perhaps, but 2 years is an everlasting time to wait."
"I'm sure our pops look like silk and they are nice enough for us. Yours is as good as new, but I forgot the burn and tear in mine. Whatever shall I do? The burn shows badly and I can't take any out."
"You must sit still all you can and keep your back out of sight. The front is all right. I shall have a new ribbon for my hair, and Marmee will lend me her little pearl pin. And my new slippers are lovely, and my gloves will do, though they aren't as nice as I'd like."
"Mine are spoiled with lemonade, and I can't get any new ones, so I shall have to go without," said Jo, who never troubled herself much about dress.
"You must wear gloves, or I won't go," cried Meg decidedly. "Gloves are more important than anything else. You can't dance without them, and if you don't, I should be so mortified."
"Then I'll stay still. I don't care much for company dancing. It's no fun to go sailing round. I like to fly about and cut capers."
"You can't ask Mother for new ones. They are so expensive, and you are so careless. She said when you spoil the others that she shouldn't get you any more this winter. Can't you make them do?" asked May anxiously.
"I can hold them crumpled up in my hands so no one will know how stained they are. That's all I can do. No, I'll tell you how we can manage. Each wear one good one and carry a bad one. Don't you see?"
"Your hands are bigger than mine, and you will stretch my glove dreadfully," began Meg, whose gloves were a tender point with her.
"Then I'll go without. I don't care what people say," cried Jo, taking up her book.
"You may have it, you may. Only don't stain it, and do behave nicely. Don't put your hands behind you or stare or say, 'Christopher Columbus,' will you?"
"Don't worry about me. I'll be as prim as I can and not get into any scrapes if I can help it. Now go and answer your note and let me finish this splendid story." So Meg went away to accept with thanks, look over her dress, and sing blithely as she did up her one real lace frill, while Jo finished her story, her four apples, and had a game of romps with Scrabble. On New Year's Eve, the parlor was deserted, for the two younger girls played dressing maids, and the two elder were absorbed in the all-important business of getting ready for the party. Simple as the toilets were, there was a great deal of running up and down, laughing and talking, and at one time a strong smell of burned hair pervaded the house. Meg wanted a few curls about her face, and Jo undertook the pin to pinch the papered locks with a pair of hot tongs.
"Ought they to smoke like that?" asked Beth from her perch on the bed.
"It's the dampness drying," replied Jo.
"What a queer smell! It's like burned feathers," observed Amy, smoothing her own pretty curls with a superior air.
"There now, I'll take off the papers and you'll see a cloud of little ringlets," said Jo, putting down the tongs.
She did take off the papers, but no cloud of ringlets appeared, for the hair came with the papers, and the horrified hairdresser laid a row of little scorched bundles on the bureau before her victim.
"Oh, oh, oh! What have you done? I'm spoiled. I can't go. My hair, oh, my hair!" wailed Meg, looking with despair at the uneven frizzle on her forehead.
"Just my luck. You shouldn't have asked me to do it. I always spoil everything. I'm so sorry, but the tongs are too hot, and so I've made a mess," groaned poor Joe, regarding the black pancakes with tears of regret.
"It isn't spoiled. Just frizzle it and tie a ribbon so the ends come on your forehead a bit, and it will look like the last fashion. I've seen many girls do it so," said Amy consolingly.
"Serves me right for trying to be fine. I wish I'd let my hair alone," cried Meg petulantly.
"So do I. It was so smooth and pretty. But it will soon grow out again," said Beth, coming to kiss and comfort the shorn sheep.
After various lesser mishaps, Meg was finished at last, and by the united exertions of the family, Joe's hair was got up and her dress on. They looked very well in their simple suits, Meg in silvery drab with a blue velvet snood, lace frills, and the pearl pin. Joe in maroon with a stiff gentlemanly linen collar and a white chrysanthemum or two for her only ornament. Each put on one nice light glove and carried one soiled one, and all pronounced the effect quite easy and fine. Meg's high-heeled slippers were very tight and hurt her, though she would not own it. And Joe's 19 hairpins all seemed stuck straight into her head, which was not exactly comfortable. But dear me, let us be elegant or die.
"Have a good time, dearies," said Mrs. March as the sisters went daintily down the walk. "Don't eat much supper and come away at 11 when I send Hannah for you." As the gate clashed behind them, a voice cried from a window.
"Girls, girls, have you both got nice pocket handkerchiefs?"
"Yes, yes, Spandy nice, and Meg has cologne on hers," cried Joe, adding with a laugh as they went on, "I do believe Marmy would ask that if we were all running away from an earthquake."
"It is one of her aristocratic tastes, and quite proper, for a real lady is always known by her neat boots, gloves, and handkerchief," replied Meg, who had a good many little aristocratic tastes of her own.
"Now, don't forget to keep the bad breath out of sight, Joe. Is my sash right, and does my hair look very bad?" said Meg as she turned from the glass in Mrs. Gardner's dressing room after a prolonged prank.
"I know I shall forget. If you see me doing anything wrong, just remind me by a wink, will you?" returned Joe, giving her collar a twitch and her head a hasty brush.
"No, winking isn't ladylike. I'll lift my eyebrows if anything is wrong, and nod if you are all right. Now hold your shoulders straight and take short steps, and don't shake hands if you are introduced to anyone. It isn't the thing."
"How do you learn all the proper ways? I never can. Isn't that music gay?"
Down they went, feeling a trifle timid, for they seldom went to parties, and informal as this little gathering was, it was an event to them. Mrs. Gardner, a stately old lady, greeted them kindly and handed them over to the eldest of her six daughters. Meg knew Sally and was at her ease very soon, but Joe, who didn't care much for girls or girlish gossip, stood about with her back carefully against the wall and felt as much out of place as a colt in a flower garden. Half a dozen jovial lads were talking about skates in another part of the room, and she longed to go and join them, for skating was one of the joys of her life. She telegraphed her wish to Meg, but the eyebrows went up so alarmingly that she dared not stir. No one came to talk to her, and one by one the group near her dwindled away till she was left alone. She could not roam about and amuse herself, for the burned breath would show. So she stared at people rather forlornly till the dancing began. Meg was asked at once, and the tight slippers tripped about so briskly that none would have guessed the pain their wearer suffered smilingly. Joe saw a big red-headed youth approaching her corner, and fearing he meant to engage her, she slipped into a curtained recess, intending to peep and enjoy herself in peace. Unfortunately, another bashful person had chosen the same refuge, for as the curtain fell behind, she found herself face to face with the Lawrence boy.
"Dear me, I didn't know anyone was here," stammered Joe, preparing to back out as speedily as she'd bounced in.
But the boy laughed and said pleasantly, though he looked a little startled, "Don't mind me, stay if you like."
"Shan't I disturb you?"
"Not a bit. I came here because I don't know many people and felt rather strange at first, you know."
"So did I. Don't go away, please, unless you'd rather."
The boy sat down again and looked at his pumps till Joe said, trying to be polite and easy, "I think I've had the pleasure of seeing you before. You live near us, don't you?"
"Next door.
And he looked up and laughed outright, for Joe's prim manner was rather funny when he remembered how they had chatted about cricket when he brought the cat home. That put Joe at her ease, and she laughed too, as she said in her heartiest way, "We did have such a good time over your nice Christmas present. Grandpa sent it. But you put it into his head, didn't you, now?" "How is your cat, Miss March?" asked the boy, trying to look sober while his black eyes shone with fun. "Nicely, thank you, Mr. Lawrence, but I'm not Miss March. I'm only Joe," returned the young lady. "I'm not Mr. Lawrence. I'm only Lori."
"Lori Lawrence. What an odd name."
"My first name is Theodore, but I don't like it, for the fellows called me Dora, so I made them say Lori instead."
"I hate my name, too. So sentimental. I wish everyone would say Joe instead of Josephine. How did you make the boys stop calling you Dora?"
"I thrashed them. I can't thrash Aunt Marsh, so I suppose I shall have to bear it." And Joe resigned herself with a sigh.
"Don't you like to dance, Miss Joe?"
asked Lori, looking as if he thought the name suited her.
"I like it well enough if there is plenty of room and everyone is lively. In a place like this, I'm sure to upset something, tread on people's toes, or do something dreadful, so I keep out of mischief and let Meg sail about. Don't you dance?"
"Sometimes. You see, I've been abroad a good many years and haven't been into company enough yet to know how you do things here."
"Abroad?" cried Joe. "Oh, tell me about it. I love dearly to hear people describe their travels."
Lori didn't seem to know where to begin, but Joe's eager question soon set him going, and he told her how he had been at school at Vevey, where the boys never wore hats and had a fleet of boats on the lake, and for holiday fun went on walking trips about Switzerland with their teachers.
"Don't I wish I'd been there," cried Joe. "Did you go to Paris?"
"We went last winter there."
"Can you talk French?"
"We were not allowed to speak anything else at Vevey."
"Do say some. I can read it, but I can't pronounce."
"Quel nom a cette jeune demoiselle en les pantoufles jolies?" said Lori good-naturedly.
"How nicely you do it. Let me see, you said, who is that young lady in the pretty slippers, didn't you?"
"Oui, mademoiselle."
"It's my sister Margaret, and you knew it was. Do you think she is pretty?"
"Yes, she makes me think of the German girls. She looks so fresh and quiet and dances like a lady." Joe quite glowed with pleasure at this boyish praise of her sister and stored it up to repeat to Meg. Both peeped and criticized and chatted till they felt like old acquaintances. Lori's bashfulness soon wore off, for Joe's gentlemanly demeanor amused and set him at his ease, and Joe was her merry self again because her dress was forgotten and nobody lifted their eyebrows at her. She liked the Lawrence boy better than ever and took several good looks at him so that she might describe him to the girls, for they had no brothers, very few male cousins, and boys were almost unknown creatures to them. Curly black hair, brown skin, big black eyes, handsome nose, fine teeth, small hands and feet, taller than I am, very polite for a boy, and altogether jolly. Wonder how old he is. It was on the tip of Joe's tongue to ask, but she checked herself in time and with unusual tact tried to find out in a roundabout way.
"I suppose you are going to college soon? I see you pegging away at your books. No, I mean studying hard." And Joe blushed at the dreadful pegging which had escaped her.
Lori smiled but didn't seem shocked and answered with a shrug, "Not for a year or two. I won't go before 17 anyway."
"Aren't you but 15? Asked Joe, looking at the tall lad, whom she had imagined 17 already.
16 next month. How I wish I was going to college. You don't look as if you liked it."
"I hate it. Nothing but grinding or skylarking. And I don't like the way fellows do either, in this country."
"What do you like?"
"To live in Italy, and to enjoy myself in my own way." Joe wanted very much to ask what his own way was, but his black brows looked rather threatening as he knit them, so she changed the subject by saying as her foot kept time,
"That's a splendid polka. Why don't you go and try it?"
"If you will come too," he answered with a gallant little bow.
"I can't, for I told Meg I wouldn't because—"
There Joe stopped and looked undecided whether to tell or to laugh.
"Because what?" asked Lori curiously.
"You won't tell?"
"Never."
"Well, I have a bad trick of standing before the fire, and so I burn my frocks, and I scorched this one, and though it's nicely mended, it shows, and Meg told me to keep still so no one would see it. You may laugh if you want to. It is funny, I know."
But Lori didn't laugh. He only looked down a minute, and the expression of his face puzzled Joe when he said very gently,
"Never mind that. I'll tell you how we can manage. There's a long hallway out there, and we can dance grandly, and no one will see us. Please come."
Joe thanked him and gladly went, wishing she had two neat gloves when she saw the nice pearl-colored ones her partner wore. The hall was empty, and they had a grand polka, for Lori danced well and taught her the German step, which delighted Joe, being full of swing and spring. When the music stopped, they sat down on the stairs to get their breath, and Lori was in the midst of an account of a student's festival at Heidelberg when Meg appeared in search of her sister. She beckoned, and Joe reluctantly followed her into a side room, where she found her on a sofa, holding her foot and looking pale.
"I've sprained my ankle. That stupid high heel turned and gave me a sad wrench. It aches so I can hardly stand, and I don't know how I'm ever going to get home," she said, rocking to and fro in pain.
"I knew you'd hurt your feet with those silly shoes. I'm sorry, but I don't see what you can do except get a carriage or stay here all night," answered Joe, softly rubbing the poor ankle as she spoke.
"I can't have a carriage without its costing ever so much. I dare say I can't get one at all, for most people come in their own, and it's a long way to the stable and no one to send.
I'll go."
"No, indeed. It's past 9 and dark as Egypt. I can't stop here, for the house is full. Sally has some girls staying with her. I'll rest till Hannah comes and then do the best I can."
"I'll ask Lori. He will go," said Jo, looking relieved as the idea occurred to her.
"Mercy, no! Don't ask or tell anyone. Get me my rubbers and put these slippers with our things. I can't dance anymore, but as soon as supper is over, watch for Hannah and tell me the minute she comes."
"They are going out to supper now. I'll stay with you. I'd rather."
"No, dear, run along and bring me some coffee. I'm so tired, I can't stir."
So Meg reclined with rubbers well hidden, and Jo went blundering away to the dining room, which she found after going into a china closet and opening the door of a room where old Mr. Gardner was taking a little private refreshment. Making a dart at the table, she secured the coffee, which she immediately spilled, thereby making the front of her dress as bad as the back.
"Oh dear, what a blunderbuss I am," exclaimed Jo, finishing Meg's glove by scrubbing her gown with it.
"Can I help you?" said a friendly voice, and there was Lori with a full cup in one hand and a plate of ice in the other.
"I was trying to get something for Meg, who is very tired, and someone shook me, and here I am in a nice state," answered Jo, glancing dismally from the stained skirt to the coffee-colored glove.
"Too bad. I was looking for someone to give this to. May I take it to your sister?"
"Oh, thank you. I'll show you where she is. I don't offer to take it myself, for I should only get into another scrape if I did."
Jo led the way, and as if used to waiting on ladies, Lori drew up a little table, brought a second installment of coffee and ice for Jo, and was so obliging that even particular Meg pronounced him a nice boy. They had a merry time over the bonbons and mottos, and were in the midst of a quiet game of buzz with two or three other young people who had strayed in, when Hannah appeared. Meg forgot her foot and rose so quickly that she was forced to catch hold of Jo with an exclamation of pain.
"Hush, don't say anything," she whispered, adding aloud, "It's nothing, I turned my foot a little, that's all," and limped upstairs to put her things on.
Hannah scolded, Meg cried, and Jo was at her wit's end until she decided to take things into her own hands. Slipping out, she ran down and, finding a servant, asked if he could get her a carriage. It happened to be a hired waiter who knew nothing about the neighborhood, and Jo was looking round for help when Lori, who had heard what she said, came up and offered his grandfather's carriage, which had just come for him, he said.
"It's so early, you can't mean to go yet,"
began Jo, looking relieved but hesitating to accept the offer.
"I always go early. I do, truly. Please, let me take you home. It's all on my way, you know, and it rains, they say."
That settled it, and telling him of Meg's mishap, Jo gratefully accepted and rushed up to bring down the rest of the party. Hannah hated rain as much as a cat does, so she made no trouble, and they rolled away in the luxurious closed carriage, feeling very festive and elegant. Lori went on the box so Meg could keep her foot up, and the girls talked over their party in freedom.
"I had a capital time."
"Did you?" asked Jo, rumpling up her hair and making herself comfortable.
"Yes, till I hurt myself.
Sally's friend Annie Muffet took a fancy to me and asked me to come and spend a week with her when Sally does. She is going in the spring when the opera comes, and it will be perfectly splendid if Mother only lets me go," answered Meg, cheering up at the thought.
"I saw you dancing with the red-headed man I ran away from. Was he nice?"
"Oh, very. His hair is auburn, not red, and he was very polite, and I had a delicious rodeo with him. He looked like a grasshopper in a fit when he did the new step. Lori and I couldn't help laughing. Did you hear us?"
"No, but it was very rude. What were you all about all that time hidden away there?"
Jo told her adventures, and by the time she'd finished, they were at home. With many thanks, they said goodnight and crept in, hoping to disturb no one. But the instant their door creaked, two little nightcaps bobbed up, and two sleepy but eager voices cried out,
"Tell about the party! Tell about the party!"
With what Meg called a great want of manners, Jo had saved some bonbons for the little girls, and they soon subsided after hearing the most thrilling events of the evening.
"I declare, it really seems like being a fine young lady to come home from the party in a carriage and sit in my dressing gown with a maid to wait upon me," said Meg as Jo bound up her foot with
arnica and brushed her hair.
I don't believe fine young ladies enjoy themselves a bit more than we do, in spite of our burned hair, old gowns, one glove apiece, and tight slippers that sprain our ankles when we are silly enough to wear them. And I think Joe was quite right. End of chapter 3.
Chapter 4. Burdens. Oh dear, how hard it does seem to take up our packs and go on, sighed Meg, the morning after the party. For now the holidays were over. The week of merrymaking did not fit her for going on easily with a task she never liked. I wish it was Christmas or New Year's all the time. Wouldn't it be fun? Answered Joe, yawning dismally. We shouldn't enjoy ourselves half so much as we do now. But it does seem so nice to have little suppers and bouquets, and go to parties and drive home, and read and rest, and not work. It's like other people, you know. And I always envy girls who do such things. I'm so fond of luxury, said Meg, trying to decide which of two shabby gowns was the least shabby. Well, we can't have it, so don't let us grumble, but shoulder our bundles and trudge along as cheerfully as Marmy does. I'm sure Aunt March is a regular old man of the sea to me, but I suppose when I've learned to carry her without complaining, she will tumble off, or get so light that I shan't mind her. This idea tickled Joe's fancy and put her in good spirits. But Meg didn't brighten, for her burden, consisting of 4 spoiled children, seemed heavier than ever. She had not heart enough even to make herself pretty, as usual, by putting on a blue neck ribbon and dressing her hair in the most becoming way. What's the use of looking nice when no one sees me but those cross midgets? And no one cares whether I'm pretty or not, she muttered, shutting her drawer with a jerk. I shall have to toil and moil all my days, with only little bits of fun now and then, and get old and ugly and sour, because I'm poor and can't enjoy my life as other girls do. It's a shame. So Meg went down wearing an injured look, and wasn't at all agreeable at breakfast time. Everyone seemed rather out of sorts and inclined to croak. Beth had a headache and lay on the sofa, trying to comfort herself with the cat and 3 kittens. Amy was fretting because her lessons were not learned, and she couldn't find her rubbers. Joe would whistle and make a great racket getting ready. Mrs. March was very busy trying to finish a letter, which must go at once, and Hannah had the grumps for being up late didn't suit her. There never was such a cross family, cried Joe, losing her temper when she had upset an inkstand, broken both bootlacings, and sat down upon her hat. You're the crossest person in it, returned Amy, washing out the sum that was all wrong with the tears that had fallen on her slate. Beth, if you don't keep these horrid cats down cellar, I'll have them drowned, exclaimed Meg angrily, as she tried to get rid of the kitten, which had scrambled up her back and stuck like a bird just out of reach. Joe laughed, Meg scolded, Beth implored, and Amy wailed because she couldn't remember how much 9 times 12 was. Girls, girls, do be quiet one minute. I must get this off by the early mail. And you drive me distracted with your worry, cried Mrs. March, crossing out the 3rd spoiled sentence in her letter. There was a momentary lull, broken by Hannah, who stalked in, laid 2 hot turnovers on the table, and stalked out again. These turnovers were an institution, and the girls called them muffs, for they had no others and found the hot pies very comforting to their hands on cold mornings. Hannah never forgot to make them, no matter how busy or grumpy she might be, for the walk was long and bleak. The poor things got no other lunch and were seldom home before 2. Cuddle your cats and get over your headache, Bethy. Goodbye, Marmy. We are all a set of rascals this morning, but we'll come home regular angels. Now then, Meg." And Joe tramped away, feeling that the pilgrims were not setting out as they ought to do. They always looked back before turning the corner, for their mother was always at the window to nod and smile and wave her hand to them. Somehow it seemed as if they couldn't have got through the day without that, for whatever their mood might be, the last glimpse of that motherly face was sure to affect them like sunshine. If Marmy shook her fist instead of kissing her hand to us, it would serve us right. "For more ungrateful wretches than we are were never seen," cried Joe, taking a remorseful satisfaction in the snowy walk and bitter wind. "Don't use such dreadful expressions," replied Meg, from the depths of the veil in which she had shrouded herself like a nun sick of the world. "I like good strong words that mean something," replied Joe, catching her hat as it took a leap off her head, preparatory to flying away altogether. "Call yourself any names you like, but I am neither a rascal nor a wretch, and I don't choose to be called so." "You're a blighted being, and decidedly cross today, because you can't sit in the lap of luxury all the time. Poor dear, just wait till I make my fortune, and you shall revel in carriages and ice cream and high-heeled slippers, and posies, and red-headed boys to dance with." "How ridiculous you are, Joe!" But Meg laughed at the nonsense and felt better in spite of herself. "Lucky for you I am, for if I put on crushed airs and tried to be dismal as you do, we should be in a nice state. Thank goodness I can always find something funny to keep me up. Don't croak any more, but come home jolly, there's a dear." Joe gave her sister an encouraging pat on the shoulder as they parted for the day, each going a different way, each hugging her little warm turnover, and each trying to be cheerful in spite of wintry weather, hard work, and the unsatisfied desires of pleasure-loving youth. When Mr. March lost his property in trying to help an unfortunate friend, the two oldest girls begged to be allowed to do something toward their own support, at least. Believing that they could not begin too early to cultivate energy, industry, and independence, their parents consented, and both fell to work with the hearty goodwill which, in spite of all obstacles, is sure to succeed at last. Margaret found a place as nursery governess and felt rich with her small salary. As she said, she was fond of luxury, and her chief trouble was poverty. She found it harder to bear than the others because she could remember a time when home was beautiful, life full of ease and pleasure, and want of any kind unknown. She tried not to be envious or discontented, but it was very natural that the young girl should long for pretty things, gay friends, accomplishments, and a happy life. At the King's she daily saw all she wanted, for the children's older sisters were just out, and Meg caught frequent glimpses of dainty ball dresses and bouquets, heard lively gossip about theaters, concerts, sleighing parties, and merrymakings of all kinds, and saw money lavished on trifles which would have been so precious to her. Poor Meg seldom complained, but a sense of injustice made her feel bitter toward everyone sometimes, for she had not yet learned to know how rich she was in the blessings which alone can make life happy. Joe happened to suit Aunt March, who was lame and needed an active person to wait upon her. The childless old lady had offered to adopt one of the girls when the troubles came, and was much offended because her offer was declined. Other friends told the Marches that they had lost all chance of being remembered in the rich old lady's will, but the unworldly Marches only said, "We can't give up our girls for a dozen fortunes. Rich or poor, we will keep together and be happy in one another." The old lady wouldn't speak to them for a time, but happening to meet Joe at a friend's, something in her comical face and blunt manners struck the old lady's fancy, and she proposed to take her for a companion. This did not suit Joe at all, but she accepted the place since nothing better appeared, and, to everyone's surprise, got on remarkably well with her irascible relative. There was an occasional tempest, and once Joe marched home, declaring she couldn't bear it longer. But Aunt March always cleared up quickly, and sent for her to come back again with such urgency that she could not refuse, for in her heart she rather liked the peppery old lady. I suspect that the real attraction was a large library of fine books, which was left to dust and spiders since Uncle March died. Joe remembered the kind old gentleman who used to let her build railroads and bridges with his big dictionaries, tell her stories about queer pictures in his Latin books, and buy her cards of gingerbread whenever he met her in the street. The dim, dusty room with the busts staring down from the tall bookcases, the cozy chairs, the globes, and best of all, the wilderness of books in which she could wander where she liked, made the library a region of bliss to her. The moment Aunt March took her nap, or was busy with company, Joe hurried to this quiet place, and curling herself up in the easy chair, devoured poetry, romance, history, travels, and pictures like a regular bookworm. But like all happiness, it did not last long, for as sure as she had just reached the heart of the story, the sweetest verse of a song, or the most perilous adventure of her traveler, a shrill voice called, "Josephine! Josephine!" and she had to leave her paradise to wind yarn, wash the poodle, or read Belsham's essays by the hour together. Joe's ambition was to do something very splendid. What it was, she had no idea as yet, but left it for time to tell her, and meanwhile found her greatest affliction in the fact that she couldn't read, run, and ride as much as she liked. A quick temper, sharp tongue, and restless spirit were always getting her into scrapes, and her life was a series of ups and downs which were both comic and pathetic. But the training she received in Aunt March's was just what she needed, and the thought that she was doing something to support herself made her happy in spite of the perpetual, "Josephine?" Beth was too bashful to go to school. It had been tried, but she suffered so much that it was given up, and she did her lessons at home with her father. Even when he went away and her mother was called to devote her skill and energy to soldiers' aid societies, Beth went faithfully on by herself and did the best she could. She was a housewifely little creature and helped Hannah keep home neat and comfortable for the workers, never thinking of any reward but to be loved. Long, quiet days she spent, not lonely nor idle, for her little world was peopled with imaginary friends, and she was by nature a busy bee. There were 6 dolls to be taken up and dressed every morning, for Beth was a child still, and loved her pets as well as ever. Not one whole or handsome one among them, all were outcasts till Beth took them in, for when her sisters outgrew these idols, they passed to her, because Amy would have nothing old or ugly. Beth cherished them all the more tenderly for that very reason, and set up a hospital for infirm dolls. No pins were ever stuck into their cotton vitals, no harsh words or blows were ever given them, no neglect ever saddened the heart of the most repulsive, but all were fed and clothed, nursed and caressed with an affection which never failed. One forlorn fragment of dullanity had belonged to Joe, and having led a tempestuous life, was left a wreck in the rag-bag, from which dreary poorhouse it was rescued by Beth and taken to her refuge. Having no top to its head, she tied on a neat little cap, and as both arms and legs were gone, she hid these deficiencies by folding it into a blanket and devoting her best bed to this chronic invalid. If anyone had known the care lavished on that dolly, I think it would have touched their hearts, even while they laughed. She brought it bits of bouquets, she read to it, took it out to breathe fresh air, hidden under her coat. She sang it lullabies and never went to bed without kissing its dirty face and whispering tenderly, "I hope you'll have a good night, my poor dear." Beth had her troubles as well as the others, and not being an angel, but a very human little girl, she often wept a little weep, as Joe said, because she couldn't take music lessons and have a fine piano. She loved music so dearly, tried so hard to learn, and practiced away so patiently at the jingling old instrument that it did seem as if someone, not to hint Aunt March, ought to help her. Nobody did, however, and nobody saw Beth wipe the tears off the yellow keys that wouldn't keep in tune when she was all alone. She sang like a little lark about her work, never was too tired for Marmee and the girls, and day after day said hopefully to herself, "I know I'll get my music sometime, if I'm good." There are many Beths in the world, shy and quiet, sitting in corners till needed, and living for others so cheerfully that no one sees the sacrifices till the little cricket on the hearth stops chirping, and the sweet, sunshiny presence vanishes, leaving silence and shadow behind. If anybody had asked Amy what the greatest trial of her life was, she would have answered at once, "My nose." When she was a baby, Joe had accidentally dropped her into the coal hod, and Amy insisted that the fall had ruined her nose forever. It was not big nor red, like poor Petria's. It was only rather flat, and all the pinching in the world could not give it an aristocratic point. No one minded it but herself, and it was doing its best to grow, but Amy felt deeply the want of a Grecian nose, and drew whole sheets of handsome ones to console herself. Little Raphael, as her sisters called her, had a decided talent for drawing, and was never so happy as when copying flowers, designing fairies, or illustrating stories with queer specimens of art. Her teachers complained that instead of doing her sums, she covered her slate with animals. The blank pages of her atlas were used to copy maps on, and caricatures of the most ludicrous description came fluttering out of her books at unlucky moments. She got through her lessons as well as she could, and managed to escape reprimands by being a model of deportment. She was a great favorite with her mates, being good-tempered and possessing the happy art of pleasing without effort. Her little airs and graces were much admired. So were her accomplishments. For besides her drawing, she could play 12 tunes, crochet, and read French without mispronouncing more than 2/3 of the words. She had a plaintive way of saying, "When Papa was rich, we did so-and-so," which was very touching, and her long words were considered perfectly elegant by the girls. Amy was in a fair way to be spoiled, for everyone petted her, and her small vanities and selfishnesses were growing nicely. One thing, however, rather quenched the vanities. She had to wear her cousin's clothes. Now Florence's mamma hadn't a particle of taste, and Amy suffered deeply at having to wear a red instead of a blue bonnet, unbecoming gowns, and fussy aprons that did not fit. Everything was good, well-made, and little worn, but Amy's artistic eyes were much afflicted, especially this winter when her school dress was a dull purple with yellow dots and no trimming. "My only comfort," she said to Meg with tears in her eyes, "is that Mother doesn't take tucks in my dresses whenever I'm naughty, as Maria Park's mother does. My dear, it's really dreadful, for sometimes she is so bad her frock is up to her knees and she can't come to school." "When I think of this degradation, I figorser, I can bear even my flat nose and purple gown with yellow skyrockets on it." Meg was Amy's confidant and monitor, and by some strange attraction of opposites, Joe was gentle Beth's. To Joe alone did the shy child tell her thoughts, and over her big harum-scarum sister, Beth unconsciously exercised more influence than anyone in the family. The two older girls were a great deal to one another, but each took one of the younger sisters into her keeping and watched over her in her own way, playing mother, they called it, and put their sisters in the places of discarded dolls with the maternal instinct of little women. "Has anybody got anything to tell? It's been such a dismal day. I'm really dying for some amusement," said Meg, as they sat sewing together that evening. "I had a queer time with Aunt today, and as I got the best of it, I'll tell you about it," began Joe, who dearly loved to tell stories. "I was reading that everlasting Belsham, and droning away as I always do, for Aunt soon drops off, and then I take out some nice book and read like fury till she wakes up. I actually made myself sleepy, and before she began to nod, I gave such a gape that she asked me what I meant by opening my mouth wide enough to take the whole book in at once. 'I wish I could and be done with it,' said I, trying not to be saucy. Then she gave me a long lecture on my sins and told me to sit and think them over while she just lost herself for a moment. She never finds herself very soon, so the minute her cap began to bob like a top-heavy dahlia, I whipped the Vicar of Wakefield out of my pocket and read away with one eye on him and one on Aunt. I just got to where they all tumbled into the water when I forgot and laughed out loud. Aunt woke up and, being more good-natured after her nap, told me to read a bit and show what frivolous work I preferred to the worthy and instructive Belsham. I did my very best, and she liked it, though she only said, 'I don't understand what it's all about. Go back and begin it, child.' Back I went and made the primroses as interesting as ever I could. Once I was wicked enough to stop in a thrilling place and say meekly, 'I'm afraid it tires you, ma'am. Shan't I stop now?' She caught up her knitting, which had dropped out of her hands, gave me a sharp look through her specs, and said in her short way, 'Finish the chapter and don't be impertinent, miss.'" "Did she own she liked it?" asked Meg. "Oh, bless you, no. But she let old Belsham rest, and when I ran back after my gloves this afternoon, there she was, so hard at the vicar that she didn't hear me laugh as I danced a jig in the hall because of the good time coming. What a pleasant life she might have if only she chose. I don't envy her much, in spite of her money, for after all, rich people have about as many worries as poor ones, I think," added Joe. "That reminds me," said Meg, "that I've got something to tell. It isn't funny like Joe's story, but I thought about it a good deal as I came home. At the King's today, I found everybody in a flurry, and one of the children said that her oldest brother had done something dreadful, and Papa had sent him away. I heard Mrs. King crying, and Mr. King talking very loud, and Grace and Ellen turned away their faces when they passed me, so I shouldn't see how red and swollen their eyes were. I didn't ask any questions, of course, but I felt so sorry for them and was rather glad I hadn't any wild brothers to do wicked things and disgrace the family. I think being disgraced in school is a great deal tryinger than anything bad boys can do," said Amy, shaking her head as if her experience of life had been a deep one. "Susie Perkins came to school today with a lovely red carnelian ring. I wanted it dreadfully, and I wished I was her with all my might. Well, she drew a picture of Mr. Davis with a monstrous nose and a hump, and the words, 'Young ladies, my eye is upon you,' coming out of his mouth in a balloon thing. We were laughing over it when all of a sudden his eye was on us, and he ordered Susie to bring up her slate. She was paralyzed with fright, but she went. And, oh, what do you think he did? He took her by the ear. The ear! Just fancy how horrid! And led her to the recitation platform and made her stand there half an hour holding the slate so everyone could see. "Didn't the girls laugh at the picture?" asked Joe, who relished the scrape. "Laugh? Not one. They sat still as mice, and Susie cried quarts. I know she did. I didn't envy her then, for I felt that millions of carnelian rings wouldn't have made me happy after that. I never, never should have got over such an agonizing mortification." And Amy went on with her work in the proud consciousness of virtue and the successful utterance of two long words in a breath. "I saw something I liked this morning, and I meant to tell it at dinner, but I forgot," said Beth, putting Joe's topsy-turvy basket in order as she talked. "When I went to get some oysters for Hannah, Mr. Lawrence was in the fish shop, but he didn't see me, for I kept behind the fish barrel, and he was busy with Mr. Cutter, the fisherman. A poor woman came in with a pail and a mop and asked Mr. Cutter if he would let her do some scrubbing for a bit of fish, because she hadn't any dinner for her children, and had been disappointed of a day's work. Mr. Cutter was in a hurry and said no, rather crossly, so she was going away looking hungry and sorry, when Mr. Lawrence hooked up a big fish with the crooked end of his cane and held it out to her. She was so glad and surprised she took it right into her arms and thanked him over and over. He told her to go along and cook it, and she hurried off so happy. Wasn't it good of him? Oh, she did look so funny hugging the big slippery fish and hoping Mr. Lawrence's bed in heaven would be aisy." When they had laughed at Beth's story, they asked their mother for one, and after a moment's thought, she said soberly, "As I sat cutting out blue flannel jackets today at the Rooms, I felt very anxious about Father, and thought how lonely and helpless we should be if anything happened to him. It was not a wise thing to do, but I kept on worrying till an old man came in with an order for some clothes. He sat down near me, and I began to talk to him, for he looked poor and tired and anxious. "Have you sons in the army?" I asked, for the note he brought was not to me. "Yes, ma'am, I had 4, but 2 were killed, 1 is a prisoner, and I'm going to the other, who is very sick in a Washington hospital," he answered quietly. "You have done a great deal for your country, sir," I said, feeling respect now instead of pity. "Not a mite more than I ought, ma'am. I'd go myself if I was any use. As I ain't, I give my boys and give 'em free." He spoke so cheerfully, looked so sincere, and seemed so glad to give his all, that I was ashamed of myself. I'd given 1 man and thought it too much, while he gave 4 without grudging them. I had all my girls to comfort me at home, and his last son was waiting miles away to say goodbye to him, perhaps. I felt so rich, so happy thinking of my blessings, that I made him a nice bundle, gave him some money, and thanked him heartily for the lesson he had taught me. "Tell another story, Mother, one with a moral to it, like this. I like to think about them afterward, if they are real and not too preachy," said Joe, after a minute's silence. Mrs. March smiled and began at once, for she had told stories to this little audience for many years, and knew how to please them. "Once upon a time there were 4 girls who had enough to eat and drink and wear, a good many comforts and pleasures, kind friends, and parents who loved them dearly, and yet they were not contented." Here the listeners stole sly looks at one another, and began to sew diligently. These girls were anxious to be good, and made many excellent resolutions, but they did not keep them very well, and were constantly saying, "If only we had this," or "If only we could do that," quite forgetting how much they already had, and how many things they actually could do. So they asked an old woman what spell they could use to make them happy, and she said, "When you feel discontented, think over your blessings and be grateful." Here Joe looked up quickly, as if about to speak, but changed her mind, seeing that the story was not yet done. Being sensible girls, they decided to try her advice, and soon were surprised to see how well off they were. One discovered that money couldn't keep shame and sorrow out of rich people's houses. Another, that though she was poor, she was a great deal happier with her youth, health, and good spirits than a certain fretful, feeble old lady who couldn't enjoy her comforts. A third, that disagreeable as it was to help get dinner, it was harder still to go begging for it. And the fourth, that even carnelian rings were not so valuable as good behavior. So they agreed to stop complaining, to enjoy the blessings they already possessed, and try to deserve them, lest they should be taken away entirely instead of increased. And I believe they were never disappointed or sorry that they took the old woman's advice. "Now, Marmy, that is very cunning of you to turn our own stories against us and give us a sermon instead of a romance," cried Meg. "I like that kind of sermon. It's the sort Father used to tell us," said Beth, thoughtfully, putting the needle straight on Joe's cushion. "I don't complain near as much as the others do, and I shall be more careful than ever now, for I've had warning from Susie's downfall," said Amy morally. "We needed that lesson, and we won't forget it. If we do so, you just say to us as old Chloe did in Uncle Tom, 'Tink up your marcies, chillen, tink up your marcies,'" added Joe, who could not, for the life of her, help getting a morsel of fun out of the little sermon, though she took it to heart as much as any of them. End of chapter 4.
You may remember that Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was what, at least the probably apocryphal but still great story, the story goes that Abraham Lincoln, upon meeting Harriet Beecher Stowe, who was also from the Northeast, he said, "So you're the little woman who started the Great War," because Northern minds didn't really understand what was going on in slavery until they read that book. And then they got a little ticked off. So, enjoy your week. I hope you have a good one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. And please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Go to knittingoutloud.com. Listen while you knit. CarolinaHomespun.com and theGoldenGateFiberInstitute.org. You can find a blog for this podcast at craftlit.blogspot.com or craftlit.libsyn.com. That's craftlit, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T, all one word, and libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And of course, you can subscribe at iTunes. Craftlit is supported by the generous donations of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And do remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.